This is Precepts Audio Message PA-262. Nathan C. Johnson, Bible Teacher. For all those who love our Lord Jesus Christ in truth.
Song of Solomon. Last time we started off with our introduction of the book, and we talked about that this book called A Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. And I said that Song of Songs, just like King of Kings means the greatest of all kings, Lord of Lords means the greatest of all lords, that the Song of Songs means the greatest of all songs. And we'll see what that means as we go through. Now, I talked about the different views of what the book is about and who is the hero of the book, who is the heroine, and who is the author of the book. And a lot of people assume here that the author must be Solomon, since it's called the Song of Solomon, or the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. But as the Companion Bible points out, the title, or in the Hebrew, where it says, of Solomon, is Le Shlomo, Shlomo being Solomon's name in Hebrew. We have the name Solomon, that comes to us through the Greek, but in Hebrew it's Shlomo. So what you have there of Solomon is Le Shlomo, and with the L-I in front. And Bullinger points out in the Companion Bible that in Hebrew, Le Shlomo is not the genitive case. Genitive would mean of Solomon or Solomon's. But the preposition lamed, or el, means two or four. And he points out that this is not necessarily limited to authorship, and we can see that in the title of Psalm 72, which uses the same word, Lishalomo. But in the title of Psalm 72, at least in the King James Version, they have translated it a psalm for Solomon, rather than a psalm of Solomon or a psalm by Solomon. He points out that it's also the expression used in, or it's also lamed, or the li, the li, used in for the chief musician. And it's therefore not necessarily limited to authorship. It may well mean concerning or relating to Solomon, the king's son. He says, moreover, the relative pronoun asher, or which, takes it out of the category of ordinary authorship and may rightly require the rendering, which is concerning Solomon. Now, he points out that it's used this way in Jeremiah 49. In Jeremiah 49, it starts out with concerning the Ammonites in Jeremiah 49 verse 1, then in verse 7 concerning Edom, and then in verse 23 concerning Damascus, and then in verse 28 concerning Kedar. Now, of course, in all these cases, these are prophecies concerning these nations, and these are not prophecies written by these nations, if a nation even could write a prophecy. So, Bullinger concludes by saying, the question of authorship, therefore, does not of necessity arise and need not be discussed. So what he means is that the title, as we have it in chapter 1, verse 1, the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's, the evidence does not at all point toward that meaning that Solomon was the author, and that the same phrase is used many times to indicate it's used in Psalm 72 to indicate for, it's translated for Solomon in King James. And then with a which, it often means concerning, like it does in Jeremiah 49. So that's what I believe we have here. I have no idea who the author is. I made a few guesses last time. They were just guesses, of course. But ultimately, we can't know who the author was. There are many, many people. When we consider, for example, some of the minor prophets, and most of the minor prophets, we wouldn't even know their names if it weren't for their prophecies appearing in the Minor Prophets. Of course, in the Hebrew, it was, as I've said, it was just one book with 12 prophets writing in it. And we wouldn't even know the names or know anything about most of those prophets if it weren't for their portions in those books. They're not mentioned anywhere else in Scripture. So it's certainly possible that Song of Solomon was written by somebody we don't know anything about and didn't write anything else. It could have been written by one of the singers or psalm writers from David's time, musicians from David's time, of course, or one from those schools of singers or musicians that David established. And could be somebody, like I said, we don't know who they are. But besides authorship, the question arises, like I said, who is it about? And I suggested that the only idea that really makes sense is that this is a love triangle. It's a story of a young country girl, her country boy lover, and Solomon, who tries to win her to himself. To me, this is really the only idea that makes sense, because all the other ideas involve exalting Solomon as a romantic hero. And when I consider that I believe that this book was inspired, like all the books of Scripture, I don't see any reason why God would inspire such a thing. I don't think that God would inspire such a thing as making Solomon, we know, had 700 wives and 300 concubines, employee wives, that God would promote him as a romantic hero. I don't think that God would do that. Now, I also explained last time that I believe that this is written in a form where it's like a play, or since it's called a song, we could call it a musical. But the interesting thing about it is that there are no, as you'd normally have in a script for something like a musical, you would have indications of the change of speaker, who is speaking, stage directions, when they enter, when they exit, where they come from, what they're to do. But there's none of that here. All we have are the lines. No indication of who speaks the lines or anything. So we have to try to gather from clues in the lines who is speaking, what they're talking about, and what the story is. Makes it a little bit difficult, but I think if we work at it, we can figure out the story. But as we go through here, I've suggested that we try to see what we can actually establish from the text, so that we're not guilty of laying our own story over the Scripture, but trying to draw the story out that's actually there. Now, we went through chapter 1, and I suggested, and I believe we can establish this from later chapters, but just so we can ground ourselves and know what's going on, that what we have is this young country girl. She has been taken, quite without her permission, has been taken into Solomon's caravan. Solomon is returning from one of his many weddings. Of course, he had 700 wives, so I suppose Solomon heading home from one of his weddings was not an unusual occurrence. So he's on his way home from one of his weddings, and on his way back to Jerusalem, he sees this country girl, happens to run into her, and is taken by her beauty. For once, he's actually falls for an Israelite girl, since he's usually marrying princesses from the nations around him. So he's taken her into his caravan. And she is dismayed because she is in love with a young country boy and wants to marry him. So we saw her interaction with some of the maids who are with her. We saw that she wanted to get a message to her beloved, let him know what happened to her. And we saw Solomon come in and try to flatter her. And then we saw, unexpectedly, while the king was at his table while he was eating, her shepherd comes. He apparently had found out what happened to her and had followed. And perhaps from some of Solomon's sympathetic servants, sympathetic to this young girl, that he is able to get an interview with her. So we saw them speaking together, and that he is overjoyed to find that she is still interested in their betrothal. I believe they were betrothed. That she is still interested in him, because as much as he is probably convinced she loves him, I suppose he's afraid any young girl, the prospect of being a queen might turn her head, rich and famous and all the rest. But he finds that she isn't interested in palaces and courts and being a queen or any of that. And she just left off the end of chapter 1 saying, "The beams of our house are cedar and our rafters are fir." In other words, she wants to live in their little wooden house in the country that she's been planning on living in when they get married, and not in Solomon's grand palace. So that's what we saw the last time. That brings us up to chapter 2. So chapter 2, verse 1. I am the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys. So here we have the young girl speak. And just so I'm not always calling her the girl or the country girl, I'm going to call her the Shulamite, because she is called that at one point in the story. And so it seems she was from the city Shulam. It's the best name we have for her, since we don't actually have a name. But the Shulamite speaks here, and she says, I am the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys. Now, since we are not from Israel and are not necessarily familiar with the flowers in that part of the world, this sounds very beautiful to us. And we know that there is the song about Jesus Christ that says, He's the lily of the valleys. And I suppose the lily of the valley. And I suppose the songwriter wrote that because that sounds very beautiful, very pretty, the lily of the valley. But if my understanding is that if we were familiar with the flowers in Israel, these two flowers, the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys, are very common flowers. They're very common flowers. So what the Shulamite, what the girl is saying here, is she is saying, I am a very common flower. So I suppose when the songwriter wrote, He's the lily of the valleys, he really didn't mean to write, He's a very common flower. But sadly, that is sort of what he was writing, at least the way it's used in Song of Solomon. But unfortunate a bit, but that's what we have here. She's saying, I'm just a common flower. She is exalting her beloved. He has exalted her. In verse 15, we said, You are fair, my love. You are fair. You have dove's eyes. In verse 16, she said, You are fair, my beloved. Pleasant. Our bed is green. Then she mentioned their house, like I said, their wooden house. And so she says, You are fair. But she's contrasting that with herself in verse 2. I am a rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys. In other words, just a common flower. Now in verse 2, her country boy lover speaks, and I tend to call him the shepherd, because for convenience, just so I'm not calling him the country boy all the time. We know nothing else about him. We don't even have a name like Shulamite to call him. Of course, I suppose he was probably from Shulam as well, or at least somewhere near Shulam that he knew her. We know that she was a vine, her family were vine dressers, he was a shepherd. So the shepherd boy responds, and he says, As the lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters. So she's called herself the lily of the valleys, a very common flower. Well, he turns that around. He says, Well, okay, you're a lily, but you're like a lily among thorns. Well, a lily might be a very common flower, but if you had the lily among thorns, of course, the lily outshines the thorns. So he takes her words, calling herself a lily, and he says, You're like a lily among the thorns. That's the way my love is among the daughters, among the other women. Well, verse 3, then she responds, As the apple tree among the trees of the wood, so is my beloved among the sons. I sat down under a shadow with great delight, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. So her response, she turns it now back to him, is, Okay, you called me a lily among the thorns, I call you an apple tree among the trees of the wood. And of course, the apple tree is superior to the other trees of the wood because of its produce. You get apples out of an apple tree. Other trees of the wood, you maybe don't get anything, but maybe some unedible acorns or who knows what. But the apple tree, you get apples. So she says, My beloved among the sons is like the apple tree among the other trees of the wood. So then she says, I sat down under his shadow with great delight. So she describes herself resting under his shadow, like she looks forward to resting in his love as they are betrothed to be married. And then says, And his fruit was sweet to my taste. So she describes her love for him like sitting under his shadow and eating his fruit. So they're almost kind of having an argument here, but this is the kind of argument you want to have. If you're arguing about, you're the better one. No, you're the better one. That's the kind of argument that draws you closer together, not farther apart. But they're arguing that you're better than me is what they're doing here. I'm nothing special. You're the special one. Verse 4, he brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. Now, it's hard to say for sure what she is describing here, but I would suggest perhaps she's describing their betrothal ceremony. They're not married yet, but they're betrothed. And this isn't our custom at all, but their custom, they actually would have a ceremony for the betrothal, and sometimes that ceremony could be even more elaborate and more important than the wedding itself. So this could be describing their betrothal ceremony. So he brings her to the vine arbor. I don't know about banqueting house, but it seems like it's vine arbor. And his banner over her, he overshaded her with his love. So that could be describing their betrothal ceremony, or I think she could be looking forward to their planned wedding when he will do this. So he brought me to the vine arbor where they were going to get married or did get betrothed, and then his banner, he overshadowed me with his love. Verse 5, she says, stay me with flagons, comfort me with apples, for I am sick of love. Now Bullinger suggests the stay me with flagons. He says the flagons are grape cakes, and he thinks the apples would more properly be rendered oranges. Now basically, I think what has happened here is that he has left, and she is now speaking again to the daughters of Jerusalem and asking for grape cakes and oranges. She wants to refresh herself. Why? Because she says, I am sick of love. Well, that might have sounded fine back in the days the King James were translated, but it gives entirely the wrong impression today. It sounds rather funny, which is, it's not really meant to be amusing. But it sounds like she's rejecting him. I'm sick of being in love, kind of thing. And this might be where that one idea I read that she was a man-hater or something like that might have gotten that from misunderstanding this verse. But the sick of love is actually sick from love. I am lovesick. I am so in love, I feel sick, is the point of what she's saying. Not that she's sick of being in love. So I am sick of love. I am sick from love. I'm lovesick. So I need grape cakes and oranges to stay me and to comfort me from my lovesickness. Verse 6, his left hand is under my head, and his right hand doth embrace me. I think she is imagining his embrace if she wants him to embrace her, or perhaps he embraced her before leaving. So she imagines resting in his embrace. And then she speaks, as I said again, to the daughters of Jerusalem, verse 7. I charge you, O ye daughters of Jerusalem, by the rose and by the hinds of the field, that ye stir not up, nor awake my love till he please. So again, she charges these daughters of Jerusalem, these would have been some of Solomon's ladies-in-waiting or his maids who are waiting on her. She charges them by the roes and the hinds of the field. Again, these would be antelope or deer-like creatures. Not to stir up nor awake her love till he please. I think what she's talking about there is that they're trying to, some of them anyway, some of them seem to be sympathetic to her and her shepherd lover, and some of them seem to be loyal to Solomon and want to convince her to fall in love with Solomon instead. And I think that makes sense if we think about the way servants would be. We could certainly see some of them feeling sorry for this poor little country girl and wanting to help her, others feeling loyal to their master Solomon and wanting to help out his suit to try to win her. So I don't think all the servants were on one side or the other. But she's charging them not to try to stir up her love till he please. She does not want to fall in love with Solomon, and she doesn't want them to try to convince her to. Okay, verse 8. The voice of my beloved. Behold, he cometh leaping upon the mountains, skipping upon the hills. Now, what do we have going on here? Well, here, it seems like we have a change of scene. And what it seems like is happening here is that the Shulamite just charged the daughters of Jerusalem, Solomon's ladies-in-waiting, not to try to stir up her love for Solomon, that she pleases to be in love with her shepherd boy, not with Solomon. And it seems that she is telling now a story that had happened the previous spring about her and her beloved to try to convince them of her love for him and that she loves him and they shouldn't be trying to stir up her love for Solomon. So she's telling a story of something that happened before she was ever taken into Solomon's caravan and while she was still back at home. So what she describes here is that she is at home and she hears the voice or the sound of her beloved. She hears her beloved coming. And she says, behold, he comes leaping upon the mountains, skipping upon the hills. So she is describing him like he is a deer. And leaping across the mountains, skipping across the hills. Very poetically, I doubt if we really saw the guy coming, that he was actually leaping and skipping along. Maybe he's a young man, so maybe he's frolicking along, but it's a little hard to picture him actually coming along like this. But she's describing it in her eyes. He's like a deer coming, leaping and skipping along toward her. She's so excited to see him. So verse 9, my beloved is like a roe or a young hart. Behold, he standeth behind our wall. He looketh forth at the windows, showing himself through the lattice. So she says, my beloved is like a roe or a young hart. So that explains why she described him as leaping upon the mountains and skipping upon the hills. He wasn't literally doing that. He would have looked rather ridiculous, I suppose. But she's describing him. He's coming. He's like the coming of a deer or an antelope coming, skipping along. Again, I think that is mostly from her excitement at seeing him. Then he arrives and she says, behold, he standeth behind our wall. So she is at their home and he is standing at the wall of their house. And he is looking for her. He's come looking for her. And so he looketh forth at the window, showing himself through the lattice. So they've got latticed windows. And he is looking in at the windows, trying to see her in the house and showing himself through the lattice. He's trying to see her, trying to get her to see him. She's already seen him, but I suppose she's a young girl. She's being kind of shy, even though she's very excited to see him. He's like an antelope or a deer come skipping along. She's excited, but she's a little shy and she's staying inside. So he's looking through the window, trying to spot her and showing himself, trying to get her to see him. So verse 10, my beloved spake and said unto me, rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. So now he speaks. He speaks to her and he says to her, rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away, my love, my beautiful one. So he wants her to get up, leave her house, and come away with him. He says, verse 11, for lo, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone. So apparently they have been parted for a time by the winter. The harsh weather of winter has kept them apart. He lives some distance away from her. They're both country kids, and maybe they live in small towns that are rather close to each other, but not the same town, like I said. So the inclement weather of the winter has kept them apart. Now the winter in that part of the world, in most of Israel, maybe not in the extreme northern parts, but for most of Israel, the winter does not involve snow, but it would involve a lot of rain and cold rain, colder temperatures with rain. So it's been cold, it's been rainy, they haven't been able to see each other over the winter, but now the winter is past and the rain is over and gone. So now he's excited they can see each other again. Verse 12, the flowers appear on the earth. The time of the singing of birds is come, and the voice of the turtle is heard in our land. So he here is pointing out evidence for the spring having arrived. He's saying the flowers appear on the earth. Now, if we've been following along through the book here, we've been probably getting the idea that this young girl likes flowers. Not at all unusual for a young girl or a young country girl. We saw her compare meeting her beloved in Solomon's caravan like coming upon a cluster of camphor, a cluster of flowers in the vineyards. She's compared herself to the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys. So I think this young man, he knows his girl, he knows his fiance, his betrothed, and he knows she likes flowers. So he says, the flowers have appeared on the earth. So exactly the kind of thing that she would want to come out and see, the new flowers springing up in the springtime. Then he says, the time of the singing of birds is come. So the birds are singing. They don't sing in the cold, rainy winter months, but they're singing their hearts out because the spring has come. Then he says, and the voice of the turtle is heard in our land. Now that, of course, is the turtle dove, not what we would call a turtle. Turtles don't sing or anything along those lines in the springtime, but this is the turtle dove. The voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land. It's a bird that migrates. So it wouldn't have been in Israel during the winter, but if you're hearing the voice of the turtle dove, that means spring has come again. In verse 13, he says, the fig tree putteth forth her green figs, and the vines with the tender grape give a good smell. Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. So he says that the fig tree, they're putting forth the green figs. The figs are on the fig tree, they're green, but they're on the tree and they're starting to ripen. Figs are ripening on the tree. Then he says, the vines with the tender grape give a good smell. Well, these would be the grape blossoms. The grape vines are in blossom, and the flowers are the blossoms on the grapevines are sending forth a lovely smell. And as we've already discovered, this girl, her family are vine dressers. So of course she is very familiar with grapes and the grape blossoms. And when they blossom in the spring. So he gives these evidence for it being spring, and then says, arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. So repeats his refrain, his first statement. Then verse 14, O my dove that art in the clefts of the rock, in the secret places of the stairs, let me see thy countenance, let me hear thy voice. For sweet is thy voice, and thy countenance is comely. So he describes her again as a dove. O my dove. And he describes her as a dove that is in the clefts of the rock. A dove hiding in the clefts of the rock, hiding in the cracks in the rock. Then he says, in the secret places of the stairs. So I think at what has happened at this point, remember, he has been looking in the window, trying to catch a glimpse of her. And I think by this verse, he has spotted her. She is shyly hanging back, perhaps partially obscured behind the stairway. And he sees her and he calls her his dove in the clefts of the rock as she is there kind of shyly hiding behind the stairs. So he says, let me see thy countenance. Let me come out so I can see your face and let me hear your voice. Answer me. Because he says, for sweet is your voice and your countenance is comely. Your countenance is good looking, good to look at. So he wants to see her, he wants to hear her. He's coaxing her to come out, his shy young fiancé. Now verse 15, take us the foxes, the little foxes, that spoil the vines, for our vines have tender grapes. Now here I think who speaks up, and we have the plural here, us, are her brothers. Remember we saw her brothers back in chapter 1 and verse 6, where she said, her mother's children were angry with me, and they made me the keeper of the vineyards. So her mother's children, her brothers, and I said whether that means they were her half-brothers, only the children of her mother, not of her father, or whether she calls them her mother's children because her father is dead, and they are in charge of her, and they actually are her full brothers, it's hard to say, but they're her brothers, either her half-brothers or full brothers, and they seem to be somewhat hard on her. And at this point, they step in. And it seems like they're kind of shocked by this young man's behavior. He is acting totally inappropriately. They don't want their young sister out gallivanting, cavorting around the hills with her young fiance. Won't people talk, and what will they say? And so they step in and get in between this couple. They're not going to allow her to go off and gallivant around the hills with her shepherd love. So they step in and say, take us the foxes, the little foxes that spoil the vines. So they say, you aren't running off with your shepherd. You are going to go into the vineyard and you're going to catch the foxes that are spoiling our vines. Because they say, for our vines have tender grapes. Our vines are tender. We don't want these foxes chewing off any of the blossoms so that we lose grapes. So you're going to go and catch the foxes. You don't have time. You have to work. You don't have time to be hanging out with your shepherd love. So verse 16, my beloved is mine and I am his. He feedeth among the lilies. So here I kind of imagine, if this was a musical, we'd kind of imagine a sad tune here. Imagine her kind of hanging her head as she trudges off to the vineyard to catch the foxes while her beloved returns home. So she assures herself, my beloved is mine and I am his. We're betrothed. We're going to get married. But he feeds among the lilies. He's feeding his sheep off among the lilies in the valleys. And here I am stuck in the vineyard catching foxes. And we are together. Verse 17, until the day break and the shadows flee away, turn, my beloved, and be thou like a roe or a young hart upon the mountains of Bether. So, assuming that she wasn't able to give him this message in front of her brothers, it seems she sends him a message. Until the day break and the shadows flee away. So it seems that she's saying, tonight. Tonight, after dark, when once we're both done working, she says, turn, my beloved. So return, come back. So she wants him to come back that night, to return that night for an interview. I suppose we would call it a date. But she makes a date with him for that night. Return tonight, because my brothers can't make me catch foxes at night. So come back tonight. Be like a roe or a young hart upon the mountains of Bether. And that seems to be the mountains of separation, is the meaning of Bether. So dance across the mountains of separation like an antelope or a deer. Race across them to me tonight. And then we will see each other. So chapter 3 and verse 1. By night on my bed, I sought him whom my soul loveth. I sought him, but I found him not. So this is continuing the story we had in chapter 2. She had sent this message to her shepherd love that they should meet that evening after dark. Now it says, by night on my bed. That's not really a word for bed, and we have to remember that the translators here didn't necessarily have this story in mind or know what was going on here. I think they're trying to translate everything as romantic as possible, so they translated this bed. But really, this is the word couch. She's not waiting for her shepherd to come for their date on her bed. She's waiting on her couch. So by night on my couch, I sought him whom my soul loveth. I sought him, but I found him not. Again, she was expecting him to come because she had sent him this message that he should come that evening. But he doesn't show up for their date, if we can call it a date. I think they had the concept of dates back then, but he doesn't show up. Now, I don't know why. I might have a suspicion that maybe her brothers had something to do with it, that they kept him from coming somehow, since they seem to be getting in the way of the relationship here. But he does not show up in verse 1. Verse 2, I will rise now and go about the city and the streets, and in the broad ways I will seek him whom my soul loveth. I sought him, but I found him not. So finally, when he does not show up, she decides she is going to get up and go around the city looking for him. So she goes around the city streets looking for him, and then the broad ways, those would be the ways around the city, the roads on the outskirts of the city. So she's looking for him everywhere, seeking the one her soul loves, but she says, I sought him, but I didn't find him. She sought him in vain. She wasn't able to find him. Verse 3. The watchmen that go about the city found me, to whom I said, saw ye him whom my soul loveth? So the city watchmen discover her. As I said, she's going on the broadways, the roads on the outskirts of the city. And so she runs into the city watchmen. And so they are watching over the city at night. During the days of Solomon, we know their cities were, or their country as a whole, was at peace and as prosperous as it ever was in all of Israel's history. So the watchmen were probably more a formal thing than they were even needed so much at this time. Typically, most of the time in the world of that day, you wouldn't want young girls wandering around at night, but at this time, and in this condition of things in Israel, she more or less would have been perfectly safe pretty much anywhere to be wandering around at night. Not necessarily the usual thing in Israel, but I think it was the thing at this time. And in our society, we almost had that kind of thing in years past. And I remember Mr. Sellers tells the story about going to New York when he was young, and that his wife and his young daughter would walk around the streets of New York at night, and they would never worry about it. They would have no reason to be concerned, and nobody ever bothered them. And he said, try to do that in the streets of New York, a woman and a young girl at night now. Well, you're not going to want to do that in New York now, but he said back then you could do it. Well, things changed, but I think Israel is, at this time was like that. She could wander around the city. But they did still have the city watch, and they found her. Now she says to them, saw ye him whom my soul loveth? Did you see my beloved? Did you see the one I love? So she asked them if they've seen him. Verse 4. It was but a little that I passed from them, but I found him whom my soul loveth. I held him and would not let him go until I had brought him into my mother's house and into the chamber of her that conceived me. Now, she doesn't tell us whether the watchman had seen him or whether they gave her any directions or not, but she does tell us it was a little bit after she passed the watchman that she found her beloved. She found him whom her soul loves. Now, notice she's telling this like she's telling a story. Again, I believe she's telling this story to the maids of Solomon, the daughters of Jerusalem, as she calls them. So she finds him, and then she says she held him. She held on to him and would not let him go. But then she said, until I had brought him into my mother's house and into the chamber of her that conceived me. Now we had, back in chapter 2, the opposition of her brothers, and maybe 2 here in chapter 3. We don't know for sure why her shepherd didn't show up at night, but again, I wonder if it was the opposition of her brothers. And they are concerned, I think, for her reputation and considering their overall seeming lack of care for her, probably more for their own reputation than they are for her reputation, because she's part of their family. But I think we have an idea among young people today that your parents are concerned about this sort of thing, but that you should try to get away with anything they let you get away with, and you shouldn't be concerned about your reputation, that you should just try to get away with things. But I think it's very interesting that is not this girl's viewpoint on things. That's not the Shulamite's viewpoint on things. She finds him, and they're together. It's the middle of the night. What are they going to do? Well, a lot of our young people want to be together in private in the middle of the night, and no wonder a lot of our young people don't maintain purity, believers or not. If you're hanging around alone at night, it's not surprising. What does she do with him? Well, she brings him to her mother's house and into the chamber of her that conceived her. Now, like I said, I believe her father is dead. That's why her brothers have charge over her, because otherwise, of course, it would be her father, not her brothers. But her mother is not dead, and so it seems that she makes her mother an ally in this. So she takes her shepherd love and takes him into her mother's house and into her mother's chamber. So, well, we can imagine young people doing who knows what if they're alone out in private and solitude in the middle of the night, and her brothers being concerned about the reputation and so forth. Well, what is going to happen if she is in the presence of her mother? Well, in the presence of her mother, we have nothing bad is going to go on. Her mother is there. They have a chaperone. So we see that it is not that she is not concerned with her reputation, that she is trying to get together with her shepherd love and going against what her brothers are trying to do to get between them. She is concerned with her reputation, and she is concerned with maintaining purity. She does not just hang around with her shepherd love out in the hills in the middle of the night, but she takes him into her mother's chamber. So she has a chaperone. And I think that is very instructive. It shows us that in spite of how in love she is with her love she is with this boy, she is concerned with her reputation, and she is concerned with maintaining purity too. And I think our young people could definitely learn a lesson from that. So verse 5, I charge you, O ye daughters of Jerusalem, by the rose and by the hinds of the field, that ye stir not up nor awake my love till he please. So here, she ends her story. She's been telling this story to the daughters of Jerusalem, like I said. And so she completes the story. She's told to try to convince them of how much she's in love with her shepherd. She wants to marry him, not Solomon. And so she ends it with the same word she began with, I charge you, O ye daughters of Jerusalem. Again, these were Solomon's ladies in waiting, his maids. So she charges them again by the rose and the hinds of the field, the antelopes and the deer, that ye stir not up nor awake my love till she please. So she's not talking about her shepherd love till he please, but her love, and love in Hebrew is feminine. So don't awake my love till she please. Don't awake my love till my love pleases to be awakened. And my love doesn't please to be awakened for Solomon. It pleases to be awakened for my betrothed, for my shepherd, who I'm in love with, not with Solomon. So stop trying to stir up my love for Solomon when that's not what my love pleases to do. So verse 6. Who is this that cometh out of the wilderness, like pillars of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all powders of the merchant? So here we have a scene change, and kind of a bad chapter break. This would be a better chapter break maybe here. But the scene changed now. We are in Jerusalem. And we have speaking here our inhabitants of Jerusalem. And Solomon and his caravan are now arriving back at Jerusalem. And so we have the inhabitants of Jerusalem commenting on Solomon's arrival and on the arrival of his entourage. So they say, who is this who comes out of the wilderness? This is one citizen of Jerusalem speaking. He sees this cloud of dust. He says, coming out of the wilderness like pillars of smoke. So we imagine the dust going up from the many mules or donkeys or camels or whatever it is that Solomon, horses, I guess. Solomon, and we're supposed to have horses in Israel, but we know Solomon had plenty of horses. So maybe it's the horses coming up. But they see the dust coming out of the wilderness like pillars of smoke. So who is this coming out of the wilderness, they say? Then perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all powders of the merchant. So they can see Solomon coming, they can see the dust, and they can smell the perfume. As Solomon and his entourage is coming, they can smell the caravan coming because of all the perfume and odors. Well, we know how wealthy Solomon was, and probably had perfumes and ointments from all over the world used liberally on him and all his servants, so seems they can smell them coming as soon as they can see them coming. So verse 7, behold his bed, which is Solomon's. 70 valiant men are about it, of the valiant of Israel. So now, another Jerusalemite speaks up, and he spots this isn't bed either, this is another word from the word we had in verse 1. This word is referring to his litter or his sedan chair. Solomon's coming in a litter or a sedan chair. So he says, behold his litter, his sedan chair. which is Solomon's. So here comes Solomon in his litter, in his sedan chair. And then he says, 60 valiant men are about it, of the valiant of Israel. So the second Jerusalemite more or less says, can't you see that Solomon from there? There's his litter. That's Solomon's litter, and there are his 60 valiant men guarding his litter. Verse 8, they all hold swords, being expert in war. Every man hath his sword upon his thigh because of fear in the night. So these mighty men, these valiant men who are surrounding Solomon, they all have swords at which they are experts. And they are wearing these swords on their thighs because of fear in the night. In other words, to guard the king from danger in the night. Now, as I said, there was peace and prosperity in Israel at this time. Seems pretty unlikely that there was any fear in the night, but these were traditional positions, probably. Verse 9, King Solomon made himself a chariot of the wood of Lebanon. So here a third Jerusalemite speaks up and notices Solomon's palanquin. And his palanquin is made of the wood of Lebanon. And Lebanon was the forest in Syria where much of the wood that was used in the making of the temple was from. There were cedar trees in Lebanon, trees that they, and wood of a quality that they didn't have in Israel, but they had in Lebanon, which was part at this time of Phoenicia, or the territory of Tyre and Sidon. So his chariot, his palanquin, not his chariot, is made of the wood of Lebanon. So verse 10, he made the pillars thereof of silver, the bottom thereof of gold, the covering of it of purple, the midst thereof being paved with love for the daughters of Jerusalem. So this palanquin, it supports, and these would be the support poles by which it's carried, by which it's borne. So the support poles of the palanquin are made of silver. And the bottom, the support of it, the bottom of it is made of gold. Then the covering, the seat of it, is made of purple cloth. So this would be the seat of the palanquin. And then the midst of it is paved with love. Or that would be, Bullinger suggests, tessellated or checkered with love. So if it's a purplish color, but it's not a solid color, it's checkered. And they say it's checkered with love for the king by the daughters of Jerusalem. So it's not for the daughters of Jerusalem, as if the daughters of Jerusalem would be riding in Solomon's sedan chair. No, it's checkered with love by the daughters of Jerusalem. So verse 11, it says, go forth, O ye daughters of Zion, and behold King Solomon with the crown wherewith his mother crowned him in the day of his espousals, and in the day of the gladness of his heart. So forth, inhabitant of Jerusalem speaks up, and he calls upon the daughters of Zion to go forth. Now the daughters of Zion, that could literally mean the women of the city, but daughters of a city seems to be sometimes used for the inhabitants or for the common people as the daughters. So either it means the women go out to greet Solomon, or just all the common people go out to greet Solomon and go out to see him. Behold King Solomon. So go out to look. He says this is too good of a sight to miss. You got to see Solomon coming back. See the parade. See him and all his cavalcade arriving. He says he can see King Solomon with the crown wherewith his mother crowned him. So he's wearing a special crown, a crown they've never seen before. And this was a crown that was put on his head by his mother, good old Bathsheba. I'm sure she gave him some great advice regarding marriage. So good old Bathsheba was with him on the day of his espousals. That would be on the day of his marriage. So on his wedding day, remember this is his latest wedding day, one of many, but on this latest wedding day of his mother had a special crown that she had crowned him with on the day of his wedding and the day of the gladness of his heart. So notice again, he is on his way back to Jerusalem wearing this special crown his mother had given him on the day of his wedding. So again, that's why I think he's returning to Jerusalem from a wedding, is from this verse right here. you would think if a king is returning with his queen, you would expect to have to say, oh, here comes the king, and look, there's the queen. But do the inhabitants notice the queen or comment on the queen? No, they comment on his crown. Because Solomon has had so many brides that who even cares about the girl? They're more excited about his crown than they are about his latest bride, because his brides are a dime a dozen, but they're excited about the crown, and that shows how on special Solomon has made him getting married. Nobody even cares about who the girl is or what she looks like. They're all excited about his crown and his sedan chair and how his sedan chair is, and about his men who are guarding him. But nobody even cares about the girl. Solomon sure doesn't. And nobody in Jerusalem does either. But notice he's on his way home from a wedding. And on his way home from a wedding, he spots another girl he wants to marry. And takes her into his entourage to try to marry her when he gets back to Jerusalem. So on his way back, he's supposedly escorting his latest bride back to Jerusalem. And he's already picking up the next one on his way back. So that's good old Solomon. The one that most expositors seem to think either wrote this book or is the romantic hero of this book. Well, I don't think Solomon's the hero. He's the goat of this book, not the hero. But here comes Solomon in his glorious parade coming back from his wedding, and of course bringing this country girl, the Shulamite, along with him. Well, we got through 2 chapters. We don't really have time to do much justice to chapters 4 and 5, I think, would go well together as a whole. So rather than starting at chapter 4, we'll end there, and we'll take up with chapter 4 and what happens to this girl in Jerusalem in our next study. So let's pray and close out the study. Lord, I thank you for the things that we studied this evening. Thank you for those who could join us. Thank you for this story of the Song of Solomon, how we see the contrast between the love of this young girl for her country boy and Solomon, who has made marriage such a common thing that nobody even cares about his latest bride as he comes back to Jerusalem. They're more just interested in his finery. And I ask that you help us to honor the gift of marriage that you've given us, and to understand the reality of love as you intended it, and not as the world tends to destroy and belittle it. Thank you for the gift of love you've given us, and most of all for your love, that you loved us so much that you died for us and gave us the ultimate example of your kind of self-sacrificial love. I ask you to help us to grow in love for each other, those of us who are married, grow in love for our spouses, and that you'll help us to honor you in that way and show forth your love to the world, whether it's to spouses or to those around us, that we will be examples of your way of looking at things and your way of doing things. Help us to serve and honor you in all that we do. Be with us until we meet again around your word. Show forth you in this dark world. Thank you most of all for your grace, Lord. Amen.